Radio Mano Papachango.
First things first, I fucked up last week. If you listened to the podcast with Doug Fry, last week's episode, you may already know this. I was in a rush to get the podcast up and I didn't have my show notes. Normally I take notes while I'm doing interviews so that if there's a particular part of the conversation that I need to edit for some reason, I've made a note there, and then when I go back and produce it, I see that and I take care of it. This week I was late because I was in Mexico and got home, and the podcast was already a couple days late, and I was stressed, and it was late at night, and whatever. Lots of excuses. The fact is, I threw the podcast together, put it up, didn't have my notes at hand, didn't realize that there were two sections that should have been edited. They weren't. And I feel terrible about it because when somebody agrees to be on the podcast, one of the things I tell them is this is a risk-free environment. If you say anything that you don't want to go out and you change your mind, whatever, you can tell me right away. You can send me an email later. As long as I haven't posted it, I'm happy to take anything out. If you know, sometimes people use a name and they say, oh, I shouldn't have used their name. You know, they forget that they're talking to tens of thousands of people, which is exactly what I want, because I want it to feel intimate and safe. And so here's a situation where somebody came to Doug's office and you can hear him, you know, having this private conversation with somebody at work. And I fucked it up. I'm sorry. I've apologized to Doug and I'm apologizing to you. So all I can tell you is that I will not post anything without looking at my show notes. I don't have time, unfortunately, to listen to the whole conversation again before I put it up. It's, you know, just taken, this podcast takes at least a day a week out of my work schedule, which these days with a book deadline looming is already more than I can afford. So I can't promise you I won't fuck up again, but I promise I certainly will try not to. If you've got no idea what I'm talking about, that's fine. because as soon as a kind listener emailed me and said, hey, dude, I think there was some stuff on there that you should have cut and you didn't, I ran home. I was in the cinema watching Guardians of the Galaxy, believe it or not. It's not my normal movie fare, but ran home, pulled down the file, re-edited it, and then re-uploaded it. So only a few hundred people downloaded, maybe 1,000 people downloaded the unedited file. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, that's why you got the edited version, but there was a version up that a bunch of people heard, and including Doug, that was unedited. So hence the apology. You know, I've been thinking about cops and America and what's going on recently. I'm sure you're aware of this if you live in the U.S. If you're not, you may even be aware of it because it's big news. The cops have been, as they have been for a long time, they've been shooting young black men, unarmed, often generally white cops. And the funny thing is, you know, we're talking about how outrageous it is that these young black men are getting shot by police. But the fact is, we've been throwing young black men into prison at highly inflated rates. So whether it results in death or it results in a long prison term, we're fucking over these young black men in this country systematically, and we've been doing it forever. You know, there's a book, I think it's called The New Jim Crow, and it's about the prison system being just the most recent manifestation of this force to marginalize and neutralize young black men. Because then, of course, they can't vote, right? They're out of the picture, they're out of their family, and then we complain about, you know, single parent families in the black community. Well, sure, if you're throwing the black guys into prison, you're going to end up with single parent families. And, you know, and then if the boyfriend comes back and is living in the house with the mother of the children, and he's busted for anything involving drugs, the mother and the children can lose their public assistance. They are punished. So, of course, the man can't even live with them because there's a risk that the family will be thrown off the only source of income they've got. And, of course, what's he going to do? He's a felon. He's got a record. He can't get a normal job. Nobody will hire him. So what's he doing? He's selling weed or he's selling coke or he's doing whatever he can do to survive. And the problem with America at this point, one of the many problems with America, is that we punish people for surviving. We set them up so the only thing they can do to survive is illegal, and then we throw them in prison for it and blame it on them. It's bullshit. It's bullshit. One of the things that I saw on Twitter is this crime while white or something like that. It's a hashtag, and it's white people talking about how they get a break from the cops. And I'm here to tell you, if I had been caught, I mean, I'd be serving I don't know how many life sentences for the various things I've done over the year. It's probably not smart for me to get specific about them. It's never involved killing anyone or hurting anyone. It's not that sort of crime. But, you know, drug crimes, crossing international borders with stuff in my backpack that shouldn't have been there. I've done that so often. I don't do it anymore. Because it's like I don't ride a motorcycle anymore. I rode a motorcycle for 7 years. I had so many close calls. Finally, I said, you know what? I'm going to this well too often. It's time to let this be, you know? I can't count on this kind of good luck forever. But the thing is, when it comes to cops and crimes, it's not good luck. It's being white. It's being white and looking straight. If I had dreadlocks and, you know, big Grateful Dead t-shirt or something, I probably would have gotten more attention. But the fact is, I just look like any other normal sort of, you know, upper middle class straight white dude. So they never checked for the acid in my backpack or the, you know, whatever I had. The fact is, if you're black, you don't get that break. If you've got an Arab name, you don't get that break. If you're Hispanic, you don't get that break. America's fucked up. Because we've got this image of ourselves as this melting pot and we're open to the world and, you know, anyone can make it if they work hard enough. That is bullshit. It is wrong. This idea of social mobility is greater in the U.S. than it is elsewhere. That is wrong. The American dream is dead and gone. There's less social mobility in the United States than in, I think it was like ranked 38th in the world. So anyway, I'm not an expert. My opinion doesn't matter any more than anyone else's, but I just want to say, yeah, if you're white and you look straight, cops don't even see you. You just go right on by. And these black guys who are getting busted for doing nothing, for walking down the fucking street, for driving while black, they're constantly being harassed by police. A lot of them can't catch a fucking break because I smoked so much weed in college. I smoked so much weed when I was in high school, even driving around, getting high in the car, a bag of weed in the glove box, never got checked, never got pulled over for that. If I were black, I would have been pulled over and I would have been busted and I would have had a record. I wouldn't have got public assistance, or what's it called? Student aid. I wouldn't have got any student aid, which means I wouldn't have got a degree. I wouldn't have got a PhD. I wouldn't have written the fucking book. I wouldn't be anywhere near where I am right now just because I would have been busted for doing the same shit everybody was doing at that age. I don't know what the answer is, but I know it's not blaming the victims. That's the thing. All I know is that it's not their fault. The system is set up to fuck them over, and they're getting fucked over. And so when they turn around and say, enough, I'm with them. All right. With that out of the way, I have a question for you. Do you or someone you love jerk off in the shower? If you do, I've got just the thing for you. A friend of mine started a company called Shower Jerk, and it's a water-activated personal lubricant with organic vitamin E. It's, in other words, it's a sex lubricant made especially for the aquatic environment. So if you're somebody who likes to have sex in a wet place, and who doesn't, check this stuff out. It's called Shower Jerk. It's at his website, showerjerk.com. Very, very cool stuff. It's you wouldn't want to use it if you're not in a wet place, because it just feels gooey and definitely not a lubricant. But once water hits it, it gets slippery and it stays on. And you can wash it off with soap, or even if it doesn't all get off, it's fine because it's good for your skin and no problem. It's interesting, very interesting idea. I have to say, I haven't jerked off in the shower for a long time, but there was a period back in my teenage years when that was the go-to place. And yeah, so I won't regale you with stories of my teenage masturbation quite yet. But anyway, check it out. Shower Jerk. Hey, makes a great Christmas gift, huh? Talk about a stocking stuffer. And go to the website and check it out. It's pretty funny. The bottle's really cool, and it's got an interesting design there. Showerjerk.com. Tell them Chris sent you. Oh, and there's a discount code. What is it? No more squeak. Right. All together. No space. No more squeak. SQUEAK. I don't know why that's the code. I don't know what squeaks in the shower, I guess, if you're like, yeah, whatever. Okay, no more squeak. You get, I think it's 10% off, showerjerk.com. Okay, what else? Ah, for the first time, I have decided to try putting a discount for the t-shirts on the website. So from now until Christmas Day, there is a 10% discount on all the t-shirts that we sell at chrisryanphd.com. What is it? Virgin Birth. Altogether, Virgin Birth is the discount code. You'll get 10% off your order if this works the way it should work. I was just dicking around in the website the other day because they updated their system. And so I was trying to figure out how things work. And I saw like, oh, wait, there's this thing where I can make a coupon. So, okay, I've made a coupon and we'll see how it works. Virgin Birth, 10% off t-shirts. I think it's 10% off the whole order, including the shipping and everything. I'm not sure. We might end up losing money on this deal, but whatever. If you want, a lot of t-shirts are going these days. It's interesting. About 70% of the audience of this podcast are in the U.S., but I would say easily half the t-shirts that we sell are going elsewhere in the world. And that's with a $15 shipping charge, because that's what we pay. We're not making any money on the shipping or anything, and I'm not making any money on the damn shirts. It's all my mom's making all the money. Hope she's investing it wisely. Anyway, it's just surprising how many of the shirts are going to Australia and the UK and Sweden and Moldova and God knows where else. So Americans, hey, buy some of these damn t-shirts. You only got, I think it's $5 or $4 or something to ship them. So 10% off from now until Christmas. And we also have the signed Sex at Dawn books. We're selling those at cost. We're not making any money at all on those. But if you want to have a signed copy of the book or send one to someone you love, drop us a line. And at chrisryanphd.com, you'll see there's a place to order those as well. We're selling them at the same cost that we pay for them at bookstores or whatever. I get a discount. There's an author discount, but honestly, it's such a pain in the ass to go through that I don't bother. It's basically the same thing you pay at a bookstore or at Amazon. The episode with Casilda has garnered an incredible response. It's already got more downloads than any episode, in a week. It's already broken all the records for every guest except Joe Rogan, I guess. It's pretty amazing and very gratifying to see how you guys seem to feel the same way about her that I do. And that's very touching. One thing that's happening is we're getting a lot of people volunteering to help her with her memoirs, which I mentioned there at the end of the podcast, just sort of in an offhand, spontaneous way. Probably 50 people have written offering to help her with that. So thank you very much. I've tried to respond to all those emails. If I haven't gotten to yours yet, I'm sorry. I will. We're holding on to all the emails from people volunteering because, honestly, Cassie isn't convinced that she's ready to do this yet. She feels, as you heard in the podcast, she's a pretty humble person, despite the fact that she's lived this amazing life. And she feels like, who am I to be writing my memoirs? You know, come on, I'm just a regular person, and I'm too, you know, I'm not special enough, and I'm not old enough, and yada, yada, yada. So I'm trying to convince her that it's worthwhile, and but she's got some other things to do and first. And so when and if she decides that it's time, we'll get in touch with you guys and figure out who's still available and who's the right match. Another thing that's happened is a lot of people have written asking if Casilda is available for consultation, either psychotherapy or health consultation, sort of holistic health consultation, because of her background being so unusual, she in Spain and in Portugal was sort of a Dr. House type person where doctors would refer their patients to her when they couldn't figure out what was going on. And often Casilda could come up with a diagnosis that other people had missed. So I've talked to Cassie about this, and it's important to understand she's not licensed in the U.S. We're moving around a lot, so I'm not sure how the licensing issue really matters because she's not based in the U.S. And she can't prescribe medications or anything unless, you know, you and she are both in Spain or Portugal or Mozambique, the three countries where she is licensed. But as far as psychotherapy or just consultation, if you write an email, go to chrisryanphd.com. If you're interested in doing this, go through the contact page there, send an email explaining what your situation is. I'll forward it on to her. If she thinks she can help, then she'll get in touch and then we'll work it out from there. This week's guest is Dan Pardee. He's a sleep scientist, overall health scientist, very interesting guy. I met him hanging out at Tucker Max's place, actually, in Austin, Texas. Dan has worked with special forces in the U.S. Military. He's worked with leading scientists, medical researchers in various places at Stanford and Dean Ornish's cardiology clinic. As you'll hear, Dan has quite a stellar resume, very smart guy, obviously. And he's got a lot to say about the modern world, our sleep patterns, various looks at health and how to improve health in different ways. So I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. I certainly did. Before we get to it, thanks to Danny Osment for the sound mastering. Thanks to ErgoDepot.com for my stand-up desk, which I'm standing in front of right now. Thanks to everybody who's been using my Amazon.com link at ChrisRyanPhD.com. If you click on that and go into Amazon and buy all your Christmas shit, 2 or 3% of your purchase money will come to support the podcast. So that's a painless way to support the podcast. Thanks to everybody who's been making donations recently. It really helps. It helps honestly, just because, as I said before, I'm putting a couple of days a week into this between the recording and the, you know, what I'm doing right now and the editing and all this stuff. And I'm constantly tempted to say, I can't keep doing the podcast, can't keep doing it. I got to write this book. I got to do this. I got to do that. But I enjoy it so much. And it's so gratifying to hear from people who, you know, I got an email this week from a guy who's an alcoholic, and he said, this podcast and Joe's and Duncan's have helped him change his life and stop drinking and find meaning in other places and confront the pain that was causing him to drink in the first place. I can't tell you how gratifying and touching it is to get emails like that. And I get quite a few of them, and I'm sure Duncan and Joe get even more. And so that's why we do this. It's not about the money, because frankly, there's next to no money. It's really about that, about making that connection. So even if I don't get a chance to answer your emails, I assure you I read them all, and they all are very touching, and I'm very grateful for all of them. If you're interested in exploring non-traditional relationships, check out kotango.com, kotango.com. That's a website that I'm involved with, put it together with a couple of friends, and it's taken off. I think there's 6,000 or 7,000 users right now. It's still in beta, but it's sort of end stage beta. So check it out. It's a lot of interesting conversations going on there. Thanks to Basin and Range for that intro music. And thank you, as always, to the great Carsey Blanton. I've switched up the music at the end. You'll hear I'm using the acoustic version now. I think her voice is just so sweet and lovely and full of emotion that her and a guitar are pretty much all I need to be happy. This is King Had a Dream by Natty, N-A-T-T-Y. I think you'll find it topical for several reasons. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week.
Tell my people I won't be coming home, I'll be walking in the streets tonight. Shaking hands with everybody I meet, saying the king had a dream and now it's my real life. The king had a dream and now it's my real life. I saw a man stop running. He ran so fast, he began to fly. He flew across America and then over the world. And if he can do it, so can I. And my children will say, so can I. Singing, yes, I am. Singing, I am a man. I know that I can, 'cause the king had a dream and now I know I can be all I can. Tell my people I won't be coming home, I'll be dancing in the streets tonight. And tell your people they can all come along. There's a party in the streets tonight. And don't you worry about no Babylon, 'cause they be switching off their guns and their hose pipes. We'll be singing freedom songs till the early morning. Come on, join in if you like. King had a dream and now it's my real life. Singing, yes, I am. Singing, I am a man. And I know that I can, 'cause the king had a dream and now I know I can I've seen over the mountaintop. I have. So the king had a dream, and now I know I can be all I can.
All right. I'm here with Dan Pardee, who we have tried to schedule this podcast probably a dozen times, and every time you have some really high level reason for canceling.
I'm a very, very important person.
You were going off to see Rob Wolf one time.
Okay. Yeah.
You were going to a friend's wedding but then you like got the wrong weekend or something. How did that turn out?
It was one of those crazy mistakes that it could happen to anybody. But my wife, we got the invitation 6 months before, and she just dropped it into the wrong weekend. And so didn't really bother to look at it. And then we said to friends, all right, we're so excited to see you this weekend at the wedding. And they stopped and were like, you mean next weekend?
Well, thank God it wasn't last weekend.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. It was
like no show at the wedding.
Right. Yeah. So it all worked out, extremely, with too much to our luck, but we had, there was one vacancy that came up in the hotel. We had everything booked for the wrong time, but it all worked out, and it was a beautiful wedding.
good. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, at least you made it. So instead of me explaining what you do, do you want to just give a quick rundown of what you're working on and why it's interesting?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'll start probably.
Because you've done so much. I mean, I remember you told me, were you working with veterans or with...
I work with Naval Special Warfare. So that includes Navy SEALs and SWCC boat operators. And that is, and I'm just feel incredibly honored to be able to work with that group of people. So that's one thing that I do on the side. And I'll give you a little bit of a background. So I've been interested in health my whole life and have had various times where I've explored a certain topic in more depth. I was fortunate enough to do lifestyle research about 15 years ago through an extension of UCSF. And what we were doing at the time was looking at how really a whole lifestyle. So diet, exercise, stress management, interpersonal relationship management. So how you talk to your spouse, how all of that will affect the progression of certain types of disease, coronary heart disease, prostate cancer. It was really, I think, groundbreaking work because so much of research, just because of the limitations of research, you have to look at one thing over a period of time, and it's not a naturalistic, kind of ecologically relevant situation, and just part of the limitations of research. So this was, I thought, really groundbreaking and good stuff. And that I left and moved on to do some other things, but that always stayed with me.
Where were you doing that again?
So I just graduated my master's in exercise physiology, and I was doing it through the Preventative Medicine Research Institute, which is run by Dr. Dean Ornish, who is
sure. The Dean Ornish recover from heart disease guy, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. He also sort of was one of the pioneers of getting meditation accepted into hospital settings, and stress reduction is an important protocol.
Yeah, he was. Exactly. He was one of those people where he was talking about these wishy-washy topics, which are now much more accepted. But at the time, as a cardiologist, it was really risky for him to do that.
Yeah.
And I think it was it was brave of him too. But he's very smart, pretty type A guy, and I think he probably experienced. This is me kind of conjecture, but I feel like he probably tried some of these things and benefited from them and thought that it could be a real valuable tool in the toolkit to help patients that are, dealing with lifestyle issues.
It's funny, isn't it, how cutting edge medical research in the West seems to be cutting into common sense.
Absolutely.
like stress is bad for your heart. Dean Ornish and Andrew Weil and a lot of these other, sort of what we're calling brave people, because they are brave because they risk their careers for pointing out the obvious.
Yeah.
Touching babies is necessary to their development. You know,
yeah.
Like what any primate knows that, but somehow, right. You know, it's sort of revolutionary to say that in the Western setting. Anyway, I interrupted you. You were doing that in Northern California?
Yeah, that office is out of Sausalito.
Right.
And it was a really nice job to drop into after I graduated with my master's. And then I went on and I worked in bioinformatics for a little while. It was an exciting time to do that. It was, the human genome was, just sequenced at that point in time. So there was a lot of interest. And, then I moved on. I worked in the pharmaceutical industry for about 10 years, in a capacity called medical affairs, where you do scientific support on products after they've been approved. So I ran a research grant program and I ran scientific publications, and it was a great, great job. And that's how I got interested in sleep, because the company that I worked for, which was working with orphan drugs, which are an orphan disease, is a disease that has a population of less than 200,000. So oftentimes large pharmaceutical companies don't find the financial incentive there because the population is too small. And so the FDA worked with this company, Orphan Medical, to basically give them special fast track approval and certain financial incentives to say, okay, hey, if you can help develop these drugs to help these people, then, you know, we will help make it the costs of bringing the drug to market. We'll try to reduce those on our end. Mm. So it was a really great company. And that's how I got really interested in sleep, because we were looking at narcolepsy. And narcolepsy, there's a drug called Xyrem, which is sodium oxybate, or GHB, which has a very controversial history. GHB is a drug of abuse. It's used on the streets.
I love GHB.
It's a very interesting drug, right?
I mean, having said that, everyone I know who has ever used GHB has had a mishap with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the dosage, and, you know, as you know better than me, the dosage is so delicate. And if you know, most drugs, you take twice as much as you should, nothing really bad's going to happen to you. But if you take twice as much GHB as you should, or you like are stupid and have it with a vodka tonic,
right?
You end up in a very interesting coma for 10 hours or 12 hours, and then you wake up feeling fantastic with a tube down your throat in the hospital.
Right. Right. It's funny. I go to Burning Man quite a bit. I haven't been in probably 5 or 6 years, but given that that was an available substance, people would G out, as they call it, which is basically them taking a dose of GHB sufficient to cause them to become unarousable. So they're in this mini coma and they're fine. You always worry about breathing in a situation like that, but unless it's the GHB is on board with alcohol or some other central nervous system depressant, then there's, the cases of real mishap are few. You might have, you know, positional asphyxia if you right. fall asleep in a really bad position and you don't wake up. Right. So there are cases where that's happened, but people would be G'ing out all the time and be like, go get Dan Party.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. They called 911. And in most cases, that's the worst thing. Well, I mean, I don't want to be liable for anyone, you know, not calling 911, but I'll tell you a crazy GHB story.
Yeah.
A friend gave me some in Spain, and I was, he gave, you know, it was liquid. It was in a water bottle.
Yeah.
And, so we, with my girlfriend and I took some and, had a great time, because the effects, are like, for those people who haven't heard about this, the effects are like the best effects of alcohol: disinhibition, physical relaxation, all that, but without the toxicity. And if memory serves, it's a substance that occurs in the body. So it's metabolized quite cleanly, and there's not a lot of residue or neurotoxicity or anything, or liver toxicity, as there is with alcohol. So you don't get a hangover from it. In fact, the next day, it's a great sleep inducer, and you feel so rested afterwards.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had a really good experience with it. And then one night we were asleep. I was sound asleep, and I woke up like, because she was making some weird noise, and she was like drooling or something. And I sort of said, are you okay? And she didn't respond. And then I shook her a little and she didn't respond. And I started freaking out. Like she's like completely wiped out in bed here. And I picked her up and her, her sphincter gave way and like, oh my God, I took her to the bathtub and was cleaning her and spraying water. And she still wasn't waking up. And I had no idea what was going on. We were just lying there sound asleep. And I called this friend who's a doctor and explained what was happening. And, you know, I checked her breathing and checked her pulse and those were both fine. And he said, well, look, it was 3 o'clock in the morning or something. He said, look, man, you could call an ambulance and, you know, they'll intubate her and see what's up. But if she's breathing and her heart rate's fine, I don't know. You might want to just stay awake with her and make sure everything's fine, you know, and just like monitor her until she wakes up. So I did. And she just slept soundly all night. And she woke up in the morning and, you know, saw the dirty sheets in the corner and everything and was just confused because she felt so healthy and great. And turns out what had happened was she was having trouble falling asleep.
Okay.
And she went and got the bottle of GHB.
Okay.
And she had a syringe and mm-hmm. she wanted to make sure she took an extremely low dose. She just wanted a little bit just to induce sleep. And this woman is a doctor, by the way.
Okay.
And so she put this syringe in. She didn't know that it was a suspension or a salt.
Mm-hmm.
And it had all settled to the bottom of the bottle.
Okay.
So she put the syringe in and sucked it up from the bottom of the bottle.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of the CCs that she was taking, it was very, very small dose. But because she didn't shake the bottle first, it ended up being a very high dose. And so she had put herself into this coma without anyone knowing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, even the most, you have to really be careful with that stuff is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very interesting drug from many different angles. The pharmacology of it, it's very unique. It basically acts like different drugs at different doses. So at one dose, it really can facilitate sleep initiation. And that's one of the reasons why narcoleptics would take it. Now, they have no trouble initiating sleep, but it actually, compared to other drugs that do affect sleep in some way, it has a unique effect on sleep architecture or the types of stages that you will go in when it's on board. And some people will then, like you said, feel really well rested when they wake up from the sleep that was induced by GHB, and more so than if they were to take Ambien or something else.
Oh, like, yeah. What happens? Does it prolong REM stage?
No. So there's two different big categories. There's slow wave sleep and then there's REM sleep. There's non-REM sleep and then there's REM. And then out of the non-REM, there's stage 1, 2, and then something called slow wave sleep. And that, you can imagine that stage 1 sleep is pretty light. Stage 2 is a little bit deeper. Certain things happen during that stage. And then during slow wave sleep, it's considered the deepest stage of sleep. So it's the hardest to arouse somebody. If you do wake somebody up during that time, they feel really disoriented. They don't really know where they are. You could have a sleep hangover if you wake up out of that state. Meaning, like, you know, you'll feel groggy for some period of time after you wake up.
Yeah.
So that there's a lot that's going on in that stage that is actually helping to restore the brain and the body for next day functioning. So it's considered one of the more restorative phases of sleep. That some people then say, oh, okay, well, then we just want to try to maximize that type. And really, the concatenation of different stages, the depth, the entirety, so the whole duration of sleep, all important stuff is going on. So it's trying to game it is not always a smart thing to do. But for some conditions where they have trouble getting into a certain stage of sleep for one reason or another, then some of these drugs can be useful. Mm. And sodium oxybate or GHB certainly seem to be. Yeah, I think I was telling – I love this conversation.
Tangentially speaking, baby. Yeah,
this is the longest introduction I've ever had.
It'll just be a two-hour introduction.
Yeah, yeah. This is a five-part interview. Yeah, so I did that for 10 years, and I'll just say the more that I learned about sleep, the more interesting it becomes. It's just a fascinating subject. So I ended up leaving and doing my PhD to pursue a PhD, and that's a pretty fun story into itself. And then at the same time, I started a company called Dan's Plan, and that was the basis of a behavior model that I had been working on while I was at the pharmaceutical company, just working on it in my mind.
So how did you get all these fucking jobs, man? These are all like prime jobs. Are you like an amazing interviewer, or is your father the head of the FDA, or, you know?
Yeah, it's mostly mafia. I felt really lucky to have got, that was a great job.
I was pumping gas when I was in college. I mean, changing people's snow tires.
Yeah, it was, I think, I get very geeked out on something if I happen to be interested in it. And so I started off at the company doing sales for the first year and a half, and ended up not at all performing like they wanted me to. Sound like I'm bragging here, but I was the number one salesperson in the country, and I'd never done before. But I didn't do it like they wanted me to. I wouldn't go visit people all the time and like try to make 7 visits to doctors a day and just kind of be like a internet pop-up screen, you know, or right. I'm just popping in. What I would do is I'd say, let's schedule an hour lunch. You know, so if I had 2 minutes with somebody, I would just use that to say, let's just have one good conversation about this. Then you can contact me if you need more information. And then I would, you know, talk to them, and every day I would probably read 3 different papers on the subject. So I just got really into it. And
you were, what were you selling?
I was working with neurologists and psychiatrists mostly, and sleep medicine specialists. So I was a sales rep for sodium oxybate to those people.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then I moved, I ended up knowing quite a bit about the drug to the point where I think I have one of the most cited publications on, you know, the neurobiology of it. And at this point, so I published that article, and they're like, well, we need to make you part of the scientific, you know, body here. So I then founded this medical affairs department. I was the first member of it, and then performed in that capacity for the remainder of my tenure at that job. But it was a great job, and for a lot of reasons. I mean, the research grant position, I was speaking with the top thought leaders, luminaries in sleep science daily. They'd submit grant proposals, and I knew a lot about the drug, so we'd have a really great conversation where I would learn from them about some, sometimes esoteric, sometimes fundamental, sometimes nuanced aspect of sleep, and then I could tell them, you know, some really good stuff about the medication. And you know, and I, because I really knew the research and how it worked, and at least what was available. And it has a great history. It had been used as an anesthetic in Russia for years. You know, people started to do research on it in the 60s. So there's a political side to it. Mm-hmm. There's this really interesting pharmacological side to it. There was the whole...
It's a criminological side to it.
Yeah.
It's used as a date rape drug, correct?
It is, yeah. So it absorbed a lot of the kind of the reputation of Rohypnol. Yeah. Or roofies, which are very different drugs. So roofies is a long-acting benzodiazepine that will cause what's something called retrograde amnesia. So what that means is that, let's say you took it or were given that drug at, let's say, 10 p.m., you might forget 5, 6, 7 hours before it would erase your memory for 5, 6, 7 hours before you even took that, before you took it at 10 p.m.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, so wow. The mechanism for that must be very interesting, because you would think those memories were already recorded.
Yeah.
And it goes and actually erases all the sort of, not only what comes up, what happens afterwards, but what happened with 4 or 5 hours before. That's fascinating.
Yes, it can make that really murky. And so it actually, you know, gives a little bit of insight into how memory is formed. You go through a process of encoding. So during the day, as you're taking in new information, you're recording the world. And then at night, you go through a process of consolidation where those recorded memories get associated into your associative memory through neural networks. So you take these little chunks of data, and then you place it into your framework of knowledge. Right. And that's where you form that's where they become more long-term memory.
So it's a filing mechanism, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you don't, let's say you record information over the day and then you don't sleep, you know, your chances of remembering, you know, let's say I was to give you a list of 20 words to remember, right, with or without sleep, there's huge differences in what you will actually remember and what you won't.
What do you think about the fact that you alluded earlier to the special forces guys you're working with? Isn't it interesting that in our society, where we know scientifically there's no question that sleep is important for all sorts of cognitive functioning, high level cognitive functioning, and yet some of the most important jobs we have, we expect people to do them on insufficient sleep.
Yeah.
You know, medical residents, pilots, truck drivers, you know, all these, you know, I know they're sort of giving lip service to pilots and truck drivers have to be away at least 8 hours or whatever. But, you know, that if it takes you an hour to get to the hotel, you have dinner, you got to have breakfast in the morning and an hour to get back to the airport, that's still only 4 or 5 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's going on there? Why isn't society respecting the science that you and others have established on this subject?
I think it is a part of a larger movement of this disconnection with our core nature as we kind of trudge forward into modernity, right? We're trying to ignore the fact that we even have biology. We're just, you know, like, for example, our lifestyles now are so disconnected from a more naturalistic and, you know, setting where we live, we wake up outside with, you know, certain light across the day, evening and night, the types of foods that we eat, the relationships that are formed.
Right.
And I think we don't easily connect to that. And we want to always suppress a lot of these tendencies so that we can achieve perhaps another goal. And I understand, you know, I understand that if someone said, hey, listen, I've got this magic, you know, pill that of course is not in existence, but I can say, you cut your sleep time in half. So you need 8 hours per night. I'm going to give you another 4 hours of perfect wakefulness and you're going to feel great every single day. That's really compelling because you're extending your life in some way. They're good, the life that you get to live. So the allure of that is there. I get it. But it's and there's also kind of a way that people will look at it where I think you're saying, oh, look how tough I am. I did this on 3 hours of sleep and look how well I performed.
Yeah, yeah. I think in the medical field, that's definitely part of it. It's the whole, you know, I did it, so you got to prove you can do it to join the club now.
Yeah.
The problem is patients are suffering because I don't care how high your IQ is and how much you studied in, you know, high school and college and med school, your brain, you know, it's like drunk driving. You know, I've made the argument, which God help me if I ever make it again. But I've made the argument that, you know, people should be able to demonstrate their capacity to drive while drunk and get a stamp on their driver's license. That, like, you know what I mean? Because laws, people react differently to different drugs, to different situations. And the problem with large scale societies, we all have to follow the same law, you know, you know, and I guess that's the, you know, the price we pay for civil, you know, calm or whatever. But there is the response to that argument I've made, which is, I think, very legitimate, is, yeah, but even if you can drive under the influence better than most people, you're still under an influence. Your hand-eye coordination is still going to be, you know, eroded from what it would have been otherwise.
Yeah.
And that's the same with doctors. If you haven't slept, you're pulling a, you know, 48-hour shift, you know, or I just interviewed a fireman the other day.
Okay.
And what they do is they do 24 hours on, 48 hours off.
Yeah.
So, you know, first of all, 24 hours of wakefulness is not natural. And then 48 hours isn't enough time to sort of recover from the, you know, whatever it is, the sort of jet lag that you get from being out of sync. So, and he said that firemen on average have about, they expect to die about 10 years earlier than they would have otherwise.
Yeah.
And he said he thought part of that was due to all the chemicals that they breathe when they're at a fire. Mm-hmm. But he said another part of it was that he thought the sleep disruption was horribly detrimental, you know, physically.
And it's consistent with other vocations that have shift work as a part of, so that, you know, yeah. without a doubt, there are some jobs that require us to be on call, as a society 24 hours a day. You know, we don't get always get sick or injured at a convenient time and then fires happen. Right. So yeah. it's, but it's a real sacrifice. If you look at, like, you know, the nurses' health study. So this is a big study where they followed nurses over a 15-year period. And they could see that their incidence of things like cancers and cardiovascular disease were not just a little bit higher, but sometimes 4 or 5 fold higher than normal population. Now they're dealing with very stressful an environment, which you could become inured to by exposure.
But do you think so?
Well, that's based, you know, if you bring this back to sleep, the part of their training is to try to inure them to the effects of sleep loss. So on one hand, yes, it can work. If you're a doctor and you've been worked a night shift for 13, 15, whatever years, a long period of time, the emotional effects of sleep loss are going to be less because you performed. You know you can. And right. you can do pretty well, but there is an objective impairment that you cannot toughen to. It'll happen, and it sometimes can be beyond your awareness. So you start doing weird things. You might revert to rules. You might start to just make errors that are completely inconsistent with your abilities. And so working with Naval Special Warfare is a really tough challenge because on one hand, you do want them to become tough to the effects of sleep loss, where they're like, you know, I can do this, because they do a lot of what's called vampire shifts. They're working at night. But then at the other hand, if they are more likely to engage in things like friendly fire and to do something that's going to hurt them or one of their, you know, one of their teammates, you also want them to be sensitive enough to that so that they can then say, okay, I know I'm in this state. I need to put myself in a better state somehow. Right? I need to give myself rest. So it's a real catch 22. It's like, yeah. Get them tough, but then also keep them sensitive to it.
Well, this gets to an ongoing dispute I had with a friend of mine who's a cardiologist. We used to talk about stress a lot, and he said his position was, Chris, I don't feel stress. Like I, you know, and he did ablations of the heart muscle. So he would thread this thing up, a catheter up through the femoral artery all the way up to the heart. And he would like watch it on a machine. And then he would go in there where there was a heart muscle that was misfiring. And he would sort of burn a circle around it to isolate it so that it wouldn't provoke atrial fibrillation.
Yeah.
And he did this, you know, 3-4 times a day. And we talked about like the stress level, like, you know, if you fuck up, this guy dies, like, boom, yeah. right there, you know? Yeah. And he was like, yeah, man, I don't feel it. You know, I don't feel stress. And my position was, you may not consciously recognize that you're feeling it, but the body responds to stress. And so, you know, and I don't know if I'm right or he's right or we're both right or whatever, but it seemed to me that the body is going to respond to stress. Just like people say, well, you know, I can tolerate cold. Like, okay, you can tolerate cold, but that doesn't mean that your capillaries and your extremities aren't constricting, you know, and that these different physiological processes aren't triggered by the lower temperature, just as physiological processes are triggered by psychological stress, whether or not you recognize that on a psychological level.
Yeah.
You know, cortisol being released, for example, is a, you know, crude example.
Yeah, you know, I think of the effects of habituation to a stimulus, right? So if you, the first time that you get exposed to something, you could be more sensitive to it. Yeah. Over repeated exposures, then you're going to have less of a response.
So you think he's right. Then it's like coffee. If you've been drinking coffee for 30 years, one or two cups aren't going to keep you awake anymore.
That's right. I know what you're saying. I mean, is he just, you know, blinded? Is he taking in all of this stress? It's having a physiological toll, but he's ignoring it. I think that, you know, there are some instances where people are suppressing the stress. But I think in his case, if he's done this, many, many times, it's very possible that he's not having what would be considered perhaps a normal reaction to something like that for somebody that's not been through that.
Oh, fuck. This is the last time I invite you on the podcast. You're telling me I'm wrong? Antonio, if you're listening, fuck you. So on the positive side, you know, we're talking about how the society ignores this research. But on the positive side, recently I saw something about how schools, some schools anyway, have started to change their scheduling to start later in the morning because it's so clear that adolescents who get up at 7:30 in the morning are doing real damage to themselves.
Yeah. And the most forward thinking, you know, cities, municipalities, schools are really looking at this research because this is, I think, one of the biggest, probably issue, one of the biggest issues for our health in society is for children, adolescents. You're growing, you still need probably 9 or 10 hours in bed, but there's something called a delay shift phase where your desire, even the, your body's telling you to go to bed later. Right, this is pretty characteristic of a teenager. You know, the parents are yelling at them, go to bed, get off your phone. They're not tired though. And that delayed phase for sleep is actually normal for that age. But then they don't get a sleep in until 11 o'clock in the morning or 10 or whatever. They have to get up at 7 o'clock to get to school by, you know, 8 or earlier. And so they're living in this chronically sleep deprived condition. And that leads to things like attention deficit. We see, you know, exact that you're, you know, a response to sleep loss that looks identical to, you know, an attention deficit kind of personality, right? So somebody that you can, if you're sleep deprived, you can focus on something, you just can't focus on it for very long.
Mm.
It takes energy to tune out all of the other competing signals and stimuli that are in our environment and just focus, attend to what's at hand. And when you don't have enough mental energy because of inadequate sleep or a shift in your circadian rhythms or that some of this 24-hour process that's determining both your sleep and wake patterns, but other things as well, when that is misaligned and you have inadequate sleep, you are making your brain changes in very conspicuous ways. And some of those, some of these changes are happened in our blind spot. Like you don't really see them, but if you need to measure somebody objectively and have them perform different tasks, there's a clear difference. It's a clear difference.
Fascinating. So is there any evolutionary reason that you can think of that teenagers would naturally stay awake later into the night?
So I haven't explored this from an academic angle, but I've heard people say that it might have, if you were with a tribe, having that's kind of the first adult responsibility would be to stay up late and watch kind of the group as they slept. So just to be alert for any possible sort of attack or predator.
That's interesting. Yeah, because that would be an easy thing for a kid to do is just sound the alarm.
Yeah.
That's, you know what, I'm researching, right now I'm reading a lot about hunter-gatherer childhood for this chapter in the book I'm working on. And that's something I'll keep an eye open for, because I have been reading about the ages at which kids in different hunter-gatherer groups start to participate in work. And I know some anthropologists who've lived for years with hunter-gatherers. I'll try to track that down for you and see if that finds any support.
I would love more information on that because it could be apocryphal, but it actually, at face value, seems to make a lot of sense.
You know, you're talking about being by the fire and, you know, that sort of thing. One thing I've thought about a lot, and this might be something that you can address, is, you know, we're talking about how the brain the brain is so plastic and it responds to things positive and negative immediately and conspicuously, as you said. And one of the things that I think has received virtually no attention, but is, at least from my perspective, potentially hugely important in human consciousness, is the role that fire has played in the evolution of the human brain.
Yeah.
Because our ancestors for, I think it's about 1 million years now, is the earliest evidence of controlled fire, have every night sat around and looked at this, stared into this dancing ever-changing, fascinating, mysterious, living yet not living thing, the fire, that, you know, gave them, that they loved, that they feared, that they used, you know, that it's such a central aspect of hunter-gatherer life, quite literally central, you know, it's people sitting around it telling stories. And it just seems to me that the brain would sort of mold itself around that over the thousands of generations that we're talking about.
So I have, I think, a story that you'll love. I was mentioning earlier, you know, light is, this sounds hokey, so unless I have enough time to explain it, light is one of the biggest factors in our health. And the reason why I say that is because, I mentioned it already, but there is this concept of circadian rhythms, and these are 24-hour repeatable daily patterns, and they happen from, you know, you see occurrences of this in behavior and physiology, things like cell cycle growth and repair. So all cells in our body have internal clocks, and those clocks, the rhythm of those clocks, they'll have their own internal rhythmicity, meaning that without guidance from another force, they will maintain a certain pattern. But all of those clocks are under the influence of something called a master clock. And that's a part of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. It's part of the hypothalamus. And that is then setting, basically it's telling the body has a timing, right? And that, and what's, and it is orchestrating, all of our, you know, all the things that I just mentioned so that they're doing the right behavior at the right time. So a really good way to get in touch with this is if you were to travel time zones, right? So you're going to Spain tomorrow. So right now you are on a certain, you're up in Portland, right?
Yeah.
All right. So your timing is set to that, to the Pacific time. Tomorrow you're going to arrive in Spain and your body is still going to be on Pacific time. But over the course of days, then you will slowly adjust to be the appropriate time for Spain. How does that happen? The primary way that happens is by light entering the eye. And there are certain cells, they're specialized cells. They were discovered by in the mid-90s by a guy, Ignacio Provencio. It's a long name. They're called intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. And what they do is they just are sensitive to light, and they transmit their signal directly to the master clock, and they say, hey, it's daytime. And so those cells are sensitive to how much exposure of light that they've gotten, the intensity of light, the wavelength. So during the day, our brains are expecting intense, bright blue light for the most part, right? And when it gets that signal, then the brain knows that it's daytime. When in the evening, the light tone will change. It'll become more amber toned. A lot of the blue light is removed. If you think about a sunset, and if you think about fire, it's very similar. It's
yeah.
Similar toned light. Now you can create something called virtual darkness. And where you can see, right? So you're getting light and you can see, but your brain is not getting the signal that it's day.
Is and that like it, a dark room or something?
You can wear glasses that will filter blue light. Or you can put on certain types of bulbs that just don't have any blue light emitted.
Right.
And yeah, so it's circadian darkness or virtual darkness, where the other types of cells in your eye that are responsible for seeing and color, those are still sensitive to that wavelength. But those other cells that I mentioned that are communicating with the clock, they are not. And so Now, modern days, what we get is people watching a lot of high definition televisions with the lights fully on in the evening. We have full control over our lighting environment. And that light, by the way, is not intense enough when we're indoors. So the intensity of indoor light compared to outdoor light is, it's a very big difference, more than you would actually guess. So for example, you can measure it in lux units. You go outside on a bright blue day, it's 100,000 lux units. And if you're indoors, it's only 2,000. So it's orders of magnitude difference.
Wow. Right?
So we work indoors all day long. So we're not getting a strong, hey, it's daytime signal. And then at night we're getting too much light. And that's telling the brain, okay, well, it's still day out. And so the effect is that master clock doesn't really know when it's day, and it causes a lot of wackiness with our 24-hour patterns. And we this is totally normal. And under, you know, exquisite control of this master clock is our neuroendocrine system. So all the hormones that are produced in our body are getting kind of controlled from this central place. And so you can see why, as we were mentioning earlier, nurses that have, you know, really increased risk of disorders, if their 24-hour rhythms are constantly being pulled and shifted, then the body's not maintaining these phase relationships, these patterns. The symphony is playing out of sync.
Well, is it playing in sync for any of us, though? Because even if you don't have a night shift job, you're, you know, like you say, you're inside during the day, so you're not getting that intense blue light from the sun, not to mention vitamin D deficiency, which now, you know, people are finally recognizing as chronic, especially in dark-skinned people living in, you know, northern latitudes. You know, and then at night we're staring at our televisions or our computer screens, which is giving us this blue light. Unless you've, I use this thing F-Lux.
That is exact. So what happens to your screen when you use F-Lux?
Yeah,
this is a computer program that you install. It's free. And so tell us about your screen.
Yeah, well, what happens is that, you know, you tell the program where you are in the world, what your latitude is, and so it calculates where the sun is in the sky. And as the sun goes down, it changes your screen wavelength from blue range down to the gold kind of color. So it starts looking like firelight the later it gets in the evening.
Yeah.
Is that legit?
Or totally.
Okay.
It's cool. Totally legit. That's another way to do what I was mentioning previous, by putting on, you know, certain blue filtering glasses, or we, like in our bedroom, we only will use, certain light bulbs. So, they filter the blue light. So if we're in bed reading at night, we're not getting a lot of blue light. It's the equivalent of using F.Lux on your computer.
Oh, good. Yeah. I only have black lights and Jimi Hendrix posters in my bedroom.
That's also, I endorse that as well.
But young people probably have no idea what I'm talking about. Do they still do that? Those black light posters, or is that, am I dating myself there? I don't know if they still exist.
I see them a little bit on Hate Street, but Hate Street is a little dated as well.
Exactly. Those are my people on Hate Street. Yeah, definitely. You know, talking about this interaction of the body and natural light patterns and all that, one of the things I've been reading about is there seems to be research suggesting that by not getting enough sunlight, kids' eyes aren't developing properly, and that's a cause for nearsightedness. Have you heard about that?
I don't know anything about that, but I wouldn't be surprised. That it's you know, the way that I think about it, and I'm really interested in the ancestral perspective on wellness, which is a good way to think of it if you're not familiar with that term, is, you know, the paleo diet. I have a lot of criticisms of that specifically, but I really love the idea of saying, okay, before all this modern technology and this modern world, what was life like? Because it's changed so rapidly. And I think that we're basically putting ourselves in very novel environments. So when I speak to this, so I do some corporate wellness speaking, and you know, if you look at an extreme example, if an astronaut goes into space, they are all of a sudden in a zero gravity environment, and they no longer, their bones are no longer getting a signal that will cause osteoblasts to form osteoclasts. And so three weeks in space will cause them to demineralize their bones so severely that they can have decreased bone mineral density for years after they return from a short mission to outer space. Hmm. Right. So what you've done is you've taken the human body and you've put it in a condition that it's not used to being in, and it doesn't know how to respond. And so that's an extreme example, but it's completely relevant to how we're living today. Getting light at weird times. We're not getting enough sun exposure, right? You talked about vitamin D. We also know that when UV light hits your skin, it will trigger. So when you eat vegetables, nitrates are placed in your skin. When you get UV light exposure on your skin, it will convert nitrates into nitric oxide, which helps to regulate blood pressure. I mean, it's just a beautiful relationship. You know, our bodies our genes expect that stimulation, and it's not there. And then we have weird things happen, but those weird things are now typical. And so we don't even know that they're weird. What's normal is actually completely abnormal.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. It's the normalization of pathology. It's everywhere. You know, I've also been reading a lot recently about the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And these, it occurs to me that the sort of circadian rhythms that you're talking about in the body must also happen in the microbiome, right? They've got their own rhythms and patterns. That was it. Go ahead. That's as far as my knowledge goes. I don't know if it's related to light in any sense. I mean, I'm sure on the skin it is, where they're, you know, and in the eyes and so on. But is there anything, digestion or other aspects of the microbiome that might be related to light?
So on Twitter, I probably put up at least one article a day about the microbiome. And
am I following you on Twitter? Jeez.
Oh, you need to be. I'm so geeky.
If I'm not, that's a huge oversight.
That's funny.
What is it? At Dan Party?
It's Dan's Plan Health.
Oh, no. See, I wouldn't have even known to look for that.
Yeah.
Okay. At Dan's Plan Health.
Dan's Plan Health. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So
there it is.
The microbiome is, I mean, I just watch in awe. This is something that was not on the radar of, you know, it was not a part of the equation for health in any way 10 years ago, except for small little kind of enclaves of people that are just, were doing the kind of the first research in the area.
Yeah.
And now possibly even to, you know, a greater extent than, you know, it's now like the new hotness, right? Everybody is looking at this. Wow. We didn't really understand just how powerful and important the relationship is between the bacteria that live within our gut, which, by the way, outnumber our own cells by a factor of 10 to 1.
Yeah.
So, you know, it kind of begs the question, are we really, like, what are we, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What is this community you call you? Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a field now called metagenomics, which is looking at the relationships between our genes and the genes of the bacteria that are harbored within us.
Right.
And we're seeing, you know, the effects on psychological processes like depression and just well-being are profound, you know, more than even expected. The relationship between the microbiome and weight gain is also really shocking, just how much, you know, just how much of an effect appears to be there. And so I think we're just beginning to really understand just how powerful that relationship is. But your question was, is there a relationship between this 24-hour patterns and our microbiome? And yeah, there appears to be. So at night, our immune system is regulated in large part in our intestines. So certain chemicals are produced, parts of the immune system are produced during sleep, during a certain time of day. And what happens is when we don't get enough sleep or we have mistimed circadian rhythms, which means that, you know, our circadian rhythms are being pulled back and forth by improper light exposure, then you can have, you will either overproduce certain chemicals or underproduce others. And that can lead to, you know, problems actually throughout the body. So autoimmune type disorders. You can also have problems of not suppressing certain pathological bacteria that exist within your gut, but are usually well controlled. And so, yes, it's scary. It's scary and fascinating at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, from a research perspective, it's fascinating that here's this massive, huge source of information and influence on health that nobody has looked at all until, like you say, 10 years ago. I mean, maybe one of the first looks at this was the guy in Australia who established that a bacteria was causing ulcers in the stomach and mm-hmm. not, you know, type A personality or whatever. But yeah, it's incredible. Did you read the recent article by the guy who gave himself a fecal transplant from a hunter-gatherer?
I think I'm aware of that, but No. And we're going to, that is as odd as that sounds, if that's a new concept to you, but, you know, whoever's listening out there.
Tell people what a fecal transplant is.
Okay. So
eat shit and live.
Yeah. They've actually now turned it into a pill, but a lot of this
research, a suppository or a pill?
A pill that you swap.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Sorry. Go ahead. I interrupted you again.
No, not at all. Yeah. So you, some of the research started where they would take germ-free mice, what that means is that they don't have any bacteria in their gut yet. So they haven't been colonized by bacteria. And in this line of research, which is just one area that they were looking at, is that if you took the feces of, which has all the bacteria in it, from an obese mouse, and you put it into a germ-free mouse, then that mouse would become obese, right? The one that had no bacteria in it would eventually become obese. Now, if you took the feces of a lean mouse and you put that into the germ-free mouse, then that germ-free mouse would not become obese. It would mimic the phenotype, or it would look exactly like whatever feces, wherever the feces came from, like that. That's what. And so that begged the question: is, well, how much is this influencing our metabolism? So that's one line of interest. But then they're also looking at it for things like IBS or irritable bowel syndrome, where you can do kind of a recolonization. So you might, there's a lot of different protocols where, you know, maybe you use a course of antibiotics and then try to repopulate the intestines with, you know, you do this fecal transplant, and they're having incredible results. And so in some instances, now it's early, we don't know all of the results, the side effects or some of the, you know, possible negative consequences of doing this, but it's a really exciting area. And so there are people that are working on trying to make it into more of like an easy, you know, pill that you would swallow, which would then populate your colony with perhaps a more favorable complement and of these bacteria. And there's thousands of species that exist, and there's large different branches. You know, there's bacteriodetes and firmicutes, and your proportion of one versus the other. We're now saying like, oh, you know, it's interesting. If you look at of obese population, they seem to have more of firmicutes or bacteriodetes. I can't remember. Versus if you look at a cross sample of lean people. And so, you know, is it the only thing that is determining our weight? No, but it could be a really important factor, and it could be a really important factor in other sorts of, you know, diseases and disorders as well. So, one, I don't think we know just how many areas that this relates to. And two, we don't know just how powerful an effect this thing can have on these conditions that are really, you know, a scourge, you know, on our society, like obesity and diabetes.
There's some disease. Maybe you know what it is. I don't remember the name of it, but there's some disease that's extremely hard to cure and very serious. And they found that, I think the procedure you mentioned, antibiotics followed by a fecal transplant from a healthy person completely solves the problem forever. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you remember the disease? It doesn't really matter. I mean, people can look it up. Just look up, you know, Google fecal transplant and you'll see the research.
It could be like colitis or something of that nature.
Yeah, it's something in the lower intestine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and this also opens up, you know, as you say, if the, you know, the receiver of the fecal transplant starts to resemble the donor, you know, physiologically, this opens up a great business opportunity for Brad Pitt.
I'd
buy some of his shit, of course, you know.
Yeah,
George, totally. You know, George Clooney shit. I could see it's like, you know, it's like the marijuana dispensaries. You could have superstar shit dispensaries.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned something in the beginning of our chat today where it was foreign for, you know, we're now like, why was it so revolutionary to hold babies? So let's circle back to that idea. We now are gaining awareness of the idea that your colony or the type of bacteria that you have is, you know, massively impacted by the relationship between the baby and the mom. Yeah. So when a child passes through the birth canal, that is, they get the bacteria from the mom's vagina will actually enter into the mouth of the baby, and that will serve to initiate the colony of in that child. And so if you are born by C-section and you're taken out of the womb and handled by a nurse, right, and put, you know, put in some quote-unquote sterile tray, like your colony is not, you're not getting your mother's bacteria, but you're actually getting colonized by random bacteria that's just in the room.
Which is very likely to be aggressive and detrimental to the child. I don't know if it was the same article or another article by this guy who's a specialist in the microbiome and who gave himself the hunter-gatherer fecal transplant, but he talked about how one of his children was born through C-section. And they immediately took a swab of the mother's vaginal fluid and smeared it all over the kid's face and body, because it's not only the digestive bacteria and various organisms, but also on the skin and in the eyes. And, you know, the whole body really needs to be covered with this stuff. And then, of course, the colostrum is a second step of you know, plenishing the digestive system with these beneficial organisms. So women who don't breastfeed their child, the kid's not getting that either. It's amazing any of us are surviving.
Yeah, it's another example of this disconnect and how, you know, how unappealing that might sound. Oh, this is gross. That's nature. That is this relationship that we have. And it's a really great example of just how impactful it is and when it starts and how immediate it is. And so now you'd also think, if we go back to the light example, kids in the NICU, they were kept in, because they wanted to be monitored, they were kept in 24-hour light rooms, dim light rooms. And that would have, you know, your own circadian system continues to develop after postnatally. And so now they're just beginning to have awareness, kind of like swabbing the child born through C-section with the, you know, the mom's bacteria. They're also now saying, okay, if you're born into the NICU, you know, you're born prematurely and you have to go into the NICU, we're going to have 12 hours of light and dark. And so that we're just beginning to like pay attention to these things that, you know, we now have ample evidence that, hey, this is actually meaningful. And all of it is leading back towards living in a more natural way. And sometimes I think we just try to outsmart ourselves with this pill, but which I'm not against. I think that that's, you know, I'm all for modern technology to try to solve some of these problems. But I'm also interested in saying, okay, well, how can we mimic a more natural existence in like a real world scenario? And let's start there. You know, we can manipulate our light environment. It's easy to do if you care enough and you know why. You know, maybe we stop doing as many C-sections, which, you know, now there's certain, I think there's a hospital in San Francisco that is doing the most in the country. Well, they get a charge more and it's faster.
Yeah. Well, you can see the, you know, when the insurance companies change their pricing policies, the number of C-sections parallel with those developments. So the rise in C-sections in the United States has nothing to do with any increase in medical necessity. It's that it's easier. It can be scheduled. The doctor can go golfing on Sunday and it on Monday morning. The whole thing is just fits into, as we said earlier, this normalized pathology of daily life in the modern world, which is, you know, completely fucked up. Getting back to sleep. When I was in college, I got into a rhythm where I stayed awake till dawn most days, till like 5-6 in the morning, and I would go to sleep as the sun was rising and sleep till noon or 1 o'clock. It was a real problem if I had any morning classes. And you know, I was studying literature, so I'd stay up reading all night and you know, I would go for a walk. There was this place where there was an outdoor light and I'd sit out there by myself in the middle of the night. And I don't know whether that was a more natural rhythm for me individually or if it was just that it was possible to really get into what I was studying because I was all alone at 4 in the morning and, you know, out by a graveyard somewhere. You know, plus the mushrooms didn't hurt. Now, are some people naturally nocturnal or are we all responding to the light signals in more or less the same ways?
So there are such things that they're called, it's your chronotype, and there are owls and larks. So people that have a more of a natural kind of inclination or tendency to either stay up later or wake up earlier. And and that can change over the lifespan, but as well. So, but I think what you mentioned was really a situation of opportunity where, and then we see this a lot. So a traditional shift work is, okay, some days a week or month, I work from 8 to 5 on the schedule. Other times on weekends, I've got a night shift and I work from midnight to 8 a.m. That's traditional shift work. There's a new type of shift work, and it's very similar to what you just described, which is like, all right, I've got this daytime life. I'm going to work and then I'm going to come home and I'm going to be with my family or friends or whatever for a little bit. And then I'm going to go back to work after, after everybody's, gone to bed. And I think a lot of people maintain this pattern where a couple times a week they stay up to get stuff done. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we're so interruptible now with technology. And certain things that require, I think, real cognitive depth can take a while to get into that zone. And sometimes, for me, if I'm writing, I need to be like, I don't produce anything good for the first couple hours. And then I get into this real zone and then I got a short window of time. Right. But I can't just snap into it. And that's just not afforded to us by, a world where we've got notifications buzzing and coming, just phone calls, interruptions at work. It's a bit sad, but yeah, I think that that's why people will just say, oh, I'm kind of a night person. I get great work done.
Right.
And that's why.
Because it's the only time you're in an environment where you can get great work done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. I've been reading about, as I said, I've been doing a lot of research on hunter-gatherer life ways for this book I'm working on. And one thing I've noticed is that anthropologists report that hunter-gatherers don't sleep the way we do. This sort of solid 8-hour, and they also don't do 3 meals a day, by the way, know? So, what I've read, and this is, in the Amazon and Africa all over the place, seems to be pretty much universal that the sleep is intermittent. It's very common for people to half the people will be sound asleep and somebody will wake up and tell a joke and everyone will laugh and then they go right back to sleep and they're like snoring a minute later. It's not this sort of fragile, delicate state that takes time to get into and then you can't be disturbed or it'll take hours to get back to sleep. It seems to be easily accessed, easy in, easy out.
So
that's one thing I've read. And the other thing is, I'm sure you're familiar with the whole medieval idea of the second sleep, of sleep being broken into two segments in medieval European society right through the 19th century until, the advent of affordable artificial light, that generally people would sleep for a few hours, then wake up, do some reading, make love, hang out, get the fire going again, whatever, and then have a second sleep. And the second sleep was seen as the more restful, deeper kind of slumber. What do you think about this? Is there physiological evidence that, that makes more sense, or that I guess artificial light really disrupted the possibility for these sorts of things?
Yeah, so there was... it was probably like a year and a half ago where you saw several different articles, New York Times, BBC. There was a researcher, history professor at Virginia Tech, Roger Ekerch, I think. Ekerch. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his last name. He was looking through these texts of medieval times and he kept noticing, just like you said, references to first and second sleep.
Right. Roger Ekerch. And his book is At Day's Close. I've got it in my hand right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I've not read it and I'd like to. I should.
I'm going to read it on the plane. I'll let you know.
Oh, good. Yeah, please do. So what I noticed is that a lot of the writers made an incorrect deduction from that finding. They said, oh, well, if there's examples pre-modernity of people that would go to bed, be up for a little bit, sleep for a while, then be up for a little while, and then go back to bed for a little while. That's a natural pattern, and 8 hours of consolidated sleep is not. Showing evidence that another pattern might also be possible, and there's historical reference to that, does not then say, well, then an 8 hour consolidated chunk is not natural, right? It just shows another pattern.
Right.
Right. And that was one, I think, common error that I found in the popular press release of this new story.
Yeah.
Now I do, biphasic sleep. Monophasic would be, all right, you go to bed, you sleep once a day, you sleep at night. And then, but there's, as you know, plenty of cultures around the world that do biphasic sleep. They'll have a siesta in the afternoon. They sleep for a little bit. It's a part of the culture. And there seems to be no untoward side effects whatsoever for cultures that maintain that pattern. So I think that, do you need to have uninterrupted sleep for 8 hours to have sound, good sleep habits? No, that does not seem to be kind of factual. Now we all will wake up 15 to 20 times per night, or it's normal. I shouldn't say we all do, but it's normal to do that. Hmm. We don't even remember them though. They're little micro arousals where we change positions, roll over, you're up for a second. And if you look at somebody under a sleep study, they'll have 15 awakenings but they'll feel like they slept soundly from when they went to bed to when they woke up. So we do have these awakenings. How much time we spend awake once we do awake is a different factor. And sometimes that can be problematic and sometimes it's not. So I don't know if you want to put it in your show notes, but I just wrote an article for chriskresser.com where I was explaining the different factors that influence when we feel awake and when we feel asleep. And the title of it is "How Much Sleep Do You Need?" It's actually not a super easy question to answer because that alertness and sleepiness is basically orchestrated by these two. It's like a dance between these two different systems. And I won't try to explain it now because it takes a little bit of time to do so. They each have their own needs, each of those systems. And one of them is trying to maintain a fairly regular pattern, which means that you're generally sleeping within a certain period. And that period generally happens to be when it's dark, in a natural environment. But it doesn't have to be, as long as it's consistent, right? What we don't see is periods where people are, or examples where people are sleeping at different times throughout the day. Every day it's different. That is a different scenario.
Right. So what about like hunter-gatherers that nap a lot?
Yeah. So napping, hunter-gatherers are often, they're often referenced for the amount of physical activity that they did. How physically active were they? But they were also, there's certainly a range from modern-day hunter-gatherers. Somewhere, a common reference would be, they might walk 5 miles a day and run another miles, and then during the course of the day, they're lifting, carrying, throwing, jumping, climbing. They're engaging in all sorts of types of physical activity, but they're also can be very sedentary at times as well.
Yeah.
And so there's this like, I'm up, I'm moving, I'm doing something, then I'm sitting and I'm lounging and maybe I'm napping.
Yeah.
So it's, you're kind of giving into, in a lot of ways, when you have time for it, which a lot of these cultures did, if they have stable food sources, you can kind of go with how you feel, which we don't always have that in our, as a part of life now. It's like, oh, I've got a meeting at 4 when I'd really rather be taking a nap.
Yeah, I hear that. What about babies? It's always seems strange to me that, people, I don't have kids. Do you have kids?
Yeah, I've got a 17-month-old.
Oh, so you're right in it right now.
Yeah.
Everybody, it's like you got to get the kid to eat. You got to get the kid to sleep. It seems weird to me. Kids are organisms. Don't they just eat anyway? Don't they get hungry and eat? Like, don't they sleep when they're tired? It seems weird that we're always trying to convince kids to do things that all organisms just do.
I don't want to try to fake or profess any sort of expertise in this domain, but it's something that I think about a lot. And I, would a child eat if they weren't hungry, or if they were hungry, would they not eat? And I think kids, from what I've noticed with my boy Desmond, there's actually times where, you seem to need to attend to them. Like you're more aware of their body than they are. Like kids, if they aren't getting enough sleep, they could get kind of hyperactive and run around and be real cranky. So you might need to help them to put them, you know, into a better place where then they can just kind of relax and go to bed. Mm-hmm. But I also really want to try to help Desmond get in tune with his own body. I think so much about, you know, again, the modern world, even like with physical activity and training, it's like, don't pay attention, just push through it, just fight it. Like everything is about like not listening to yourself and just going out there and charging. And I really want him to be like, oh, you know, I'm going to eat now because I'm hungry, not because it's dinner time and because, you know, I need to finish my plate. And I think that was part of a previous generation, which is, all right, you got to finish your plate. There's starving kids other places in the world. And now I think we really need to teach. I mean, we have this abundance of food. Obesity is a massive problem. Teach people to really attend to their own signals of satiety.
Yeah.
And I grew up and I was an obese kid. And my mom loved me through food, and she would just be feeding me. Luckily I was an athletic kid too, but it probably wasn't until my mid-20s where I was like, oh my gosh, you do not have to actually eat until you're uncomfortable.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Because you're extremely fit now. People who haven't seen you, you're in very good shape.
Oh, well, thanks. And it's, you know, I struggle.
Nice ass. You have a really nice ass.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
That's awesome to hear. I mean, I grew up with insecurities about that because I was, you know, I was chubby and I never felt, you know, I was pretty athletic. I was always one of the better kids at sports, but I was like, gosh, I don't look like I think I should, given, you know, I want to look like an athlete and I, you know, got love handles.
handles before you're getting love, huh?
Exactly. Probably had a lot to do with the delay there. It's been fun for me to go through this process of just trying to really attend to, like, all right, what is my body telling me, and how to, you know, and just like, what's my hunger? What's my sleepiness? What's my, you know, and the more I've been able to, tap into that and focus on it and then attend to it and give my body what it needs, I think the better overall that I feel. And I live, you know, I'm really pleased with my lifestyle. Now it has everything to do with my business. You know, it's like, for example, my company Dance Plan, it's all about trying to help people live a healthy lifestyle. And it does so by, you know, education, all sorts of ways. Like, what, you know, what are all the different tools that we have available to try to, you know, help this really kind of incorrigible problem? And I was a part of it. There's a point to the story. Part of it, I've created something called InTune Training, and it stands for Integrative and Opportunistic. So a typical way that we do physical activity is like, all right, I'm going to go to a special place. I'm going to put on special, you know, a special costume, and I'm going to work out for 40 minutes. InTune Training, you know, and that's normal. That's a workout. That's how we get our physical activity. I try to decouple that and think, okay, so how can I integrate movement? So InTune, integrating opportunistic, how do I integrate movement into my day? And I do it in this opportunistic fashion. So I'm always looking for a place to do, all right, I can do some lunges, some push-ups. And I'm like, I've got 16 hours of the day when I'm awake where I can mix more kind of punctuated bouts of intense movement into my day.
Sorry, go ahead. Do you wear like a Fitbit or something?
Yeah, so I wear a Fitbit to track my low intensity activity, and I aim for 10,000 steps a day. I really enjoy using that because that sort of feedback, just, I know it affects my behavior. So it's not about like, oh, I don't know what 10,000 steps feels like. It's more that when I wear it, I'm more likely to continue to live closer to that goal of mine.
Yeah.
So I have like, I want to try to promote a mixed intensity movement practice in my life. So I have some higher intensity activities, some low intensity activities, some rest. It's good.
Yeah. Good. I've got a jawbone, that was actually swag when I did the TED talk.
Oh, cool.
And it's cool, but the problem, does the Fitbit, can you see how you're doing on the Fitbit itself, or do you have to plug it into a computer or something?
So some of them, so Fitbit is a service that has multiple devices. They even have body weight scales that will wirelessly transmit your information. They have a couple of devices where you get the feedback right on the device, and some where they give you some feedback where there's certain lights that will light up. So, if you're getting closer to the green light, then you're getting closer to your goal. I have one called the Force. They actually recalled it. Because a certain percentage of people were getting a rash because there was some nickel in the band.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like it because it has, I still wear mine. It's got the time and then my steps so I can check in with it, multiple times a day.
That would be good. Because mine, you have to like plug into the phone and sync it and all that. So I never know how close I am. And the other thing that bums me out is I got a bike and I don't get any credit for riding the bike.
Yeah. So I gave a presentation on this field is called quantified self, and or at least it was named by a couple of former editors of Wired magazine they were noticing, hey, there's with all sorts of new technologies, we can now measure whether it's crude like pen and paper, like, hey, I wrote down this is what I did today, to more sophisticated like these wireless devices that passively collect information if you wear them on your body, and then they can, perhaps do interesting things with that data. It's a whole new field. And so I spoke last month at Stanford Medicine X, and I talked about like, here are some of the strengths and limitations, but very soon, right now, it's still a little bit in the early adopter mode, but within the next 5 years, it'll be really common for most people to be instrumented with these sensors that are giving them feedback of like, hey, this is going on. You can attend to that. If you do it well, it could be like a dashboard of a car, right? And you're going to be like, oh, okay, let me just modify my behavior a little bit so that, in that analogy, you're not getting speeding tickets and you're making sure that you're not running out of gas, oil just change. It'll be similar, but for your lifestyle, like, okay, let me turn down the lights or let me walk a little bit more while we're on this call. And it can change how you live. And we need that more than ever because it's so easy to just be disconnected from it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Listen, I've taken up a lot of your time. I don't want to, now that I've got you, I don't want to let you go, though.
And
all the excuses you're going to come up with next time I join you. But let me sort of wrap it up by asking you a personal question. Sure. If you could take a pill and have no detrimental effects at all and never sleep again, would you?
Wow. Yes.
So you would take the blue pill?
I would, because if I love to sleep, it's funny. It's like the opposite of what I try to promote, because I don't think that that's a real possibility.
Yeah.
But if it was, then if I could feel really alert and great, vigilant, and there was no consequences to it, then that would be great. And I love sleep now because of what it can do for me, how I feel during the day. But if I could feel that way without it, I would.
So you don't find any sort of intrinsic value in dreaming, for example, that you would miss?
Yeah, that is an add-on interesting question. It's like, well, is there, could I find the space to do, have quiet wakefulness where I could sit and process my thoughts and,
I wonder, I know it's a very crude way of looking at the brain, but the whole right brain, left brain thing, I wonder if we didn't dream, if we would become less dreamy animals, you know what I mean? If we'd become less sensitive to music maybe, or, to mystery of any sort, if we weren't spending a good chunk of our time just completely immersed in mystery, which is what dreams feel like to me anyway.
So, now that I've said I would take the blue pill, because,
you meant Viagra, right?
Yeah, exactly. The idea of being able to have no consequences and more time awake is really appealing, but I don't think it's a possibility. You know, it will be sold. New drugs will come out. It is a part of our biology. It's a part of who we are. And I think actually the more that you attend to that and give into it, and even like I keep myself really busy, the business, my research, other stuff, but I prioritize my lifestyle, actually my health, because I feel like I don't do any of it well. And I can't afford to not do it as well. I mean, I'm a pretty normal intelligence guy. And so I need to like make sure that I'm operating at my best every day. Like I'd rather have 16 or 12 really good hours of alertness than 18 hours of subpar.
Right.
Because I'm not just putting widgets in boxes. I have to like really think.
Yeah. Well, that takes us back to what we were talking about initially with, you know, pilots and you know, medical residents.
Yeah.
Who aren't putting widgets in boxes, and yet they're functioning under this with this huge deficit.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I don't know if you and I have ever spoken about Stanley Krippner, he's been on this show three times, I think. He was my thesis advisor in grad school and then became a very good friend, and he and I have traveled all over the world. But he ran the sleep lab at Maimonides Medical Center in New York for 3 or 4 years in the 70s and did some really interesting research where he was looking at people's susceptibility to telepathic signals in hypnagogic and hypnopompic states.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So as they were entering, because the hypothesis was that the mind was more open to these sorts of inputs. And they found some extremely significant results, not with everyone, but some people appeared to be very sensitive to images that were being sent to them from someone in a different part of the hospital.
Yeah, so a hypnopompic or hypnagogic hallucination, hypnopompic is... means that you're having a kind of a dreamlike experience, but over wakefulness as you're going to sleep. And a hypnagogic hallucination is when you're coming out of sleep. And so it's been thought of as almost a transitory state. So if you think about sleep and wake, it's like a flip-flop switch in kind of electrical engineering. You're either in one state or the other, right? You're not in these transitional states. And that actually has been not argued, but researched. Can you actually be in these transitional states? And there's evidence where that is a possibility. So when you're having, oftentimes, if you're having one of these hallucinations, which by the way are very, some of the research that I, or the colleagues that I work with in the Netherlands have published on the differences between these hypnagogic hallucinations and schizophrenic hallucinations. And they're different. It's a different type of, you know, kind of mentation, but the evidence suggests that you're having kind of like a REM episode, which is during REM sleep, you're producing dreams. It's kind of a part of that stage. And what you're doing is you're recursively playing over and over and over again things that your body, your mind has taken in, experiences, and that can be very abstracted from the actual experience. But the kind of the deepest analysis into what REM sleep is doing is that it's trying to then figure out what are the problems that I need to solve, and how do I work on them? And so there's an active process of pruning away some memories. So it's like, oh, this is not important. I don't really need this to take up space in my brain. And then there's another part where it's like, this seems to be important. I'm going to strengthen those connections by replaying them over and over again. So that's a little bit of a kind of a diversion. But REM sleep can, you know, these hallucinations, I think, are like overlaying some dreamlike behavior, but over wakefulness. So it feels like you're hallucinating. You are. And I think a lot of UFO sightings, if not all of them, ghosts, right? Oftentimes, it's right during one of these transitional states. At night, you're on, you know, the credible police officer is driving down this road on, you know, Highway 69, and it's boring and nighttime, right? And they all of a sudden, they see, you know, their experience is real. They're not psychotic. It's just a part of our biology. And about, you know, 10% of the population will experience these sorts of hallucinations. If you have narcolepsy, you'll experience them much more frequently. Up to 30% of people will experience them. So Yeah, that's fascinating that you did some work with them. That's just a little color about what they are and other things that it can relate to. I've not thought about it as kind of analyzing, psychoanalyzing them and thinking about, you know, what have those experiences been? And is there an evolutionary purpose for some of them? And was it helping us connect to certain meaning in our life? You know, that's a fun conversation to have, but it could be really fun, you know, interesting to explore that. But
yeah, and also to sort of look at how altered states of consciousness of other sorts, whether induced by trance or various sacred plants or what have you, mm-hmm. What the similarities are to different stages of sleep.
Yeah. There's a guy, Roland Griffiths, who's one of the most, you know, kind of preeminent researchers on drugs of abuse. He has a stellar reputation. He's at Johns Hopkins. He's towards the end of his career. He's such a good researcher that he is, you know, he's done all, and it's hard to get access to these drugs to do research on them, but he's done research on MDMA and psilocybin and GHB. And that's how we met. So we have a paper together on the abuse potential, abuse liability of GHB together. But before we published that paper, he had published some real groundbreaking work, at least for mainstream medicine, on the effects of psilocybin. And one of my friends was a guide in the study, and he's a he actually, you know, won a very prestigious award for postdocs. He basically was like the postdoc of the year for all of Johns Hopkins. He was a really smart guy. But he would bring these people and they'd give them psilocybin and they would read texts from the 60s about how to induce, you know, a positive experience. And so they would play music and they would guide them through their journey. And a lot of everybody that had done that was a part of the study had claimed to be drug naive. So they had never done it before. And when they surveyed the people that had done the drugs, they all listed it as one of the top five experiences that they ever had in their life. So they rated up there with having their baby, you know, having a baby and being married or whatever was, it was at that level.
Yeah. With lasting effects, lifelong effects.
Lifelong effects, you know, and it was so nice to see a real serious scientific investigation into this idea that we are too immature to kind of, even consider in modern world. It's just like, oh, that's bad, you know? And, yeah. Yeah. And we really miss out on that.
Well, you're joining a fraternity of a lot of those people by being on this podcast. I have had, Rick Doblin. I just spoke to him the other day, who's the head of MAPS, which funds a lot of the research that, looks into these sorts of things. He's been petitioning the government to allow this research for about 25 years, and he's finally started to make some headway. You know, Charles Grobe, who used MDMA and psilocybin in terminal cancer patients to help them deal with end-of-life anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, Andrew Weil, who's been working with altered states and healing forever. Mm-hmm. Some fantastic people. Dennis McKenna, you know, Terrence's brother, was on a couple months ago. So, excuse me. Listen, thank you so much, man. I know you're a busy guy, and I don't want to abuse your generosity by continuing to pick your brain. But I hope when life calms down a little bit, we can do it again. Maybe sit down in person sometime and talk again. This is such fascinating stuff, and your research is really interesting. Thanks for sharing it with us.
I'd love to. I promise I'd love to be on again. This is really fun for me to be here. So thanks. And I won't be as much of a diva this next time. It was a strange kind of sequence of weird events.
No, I'm just giving you a hard time. That's how Irish people express affection.
Yeah. And, but yeah, no, I'd love to be back on. And I can tell you more specifically about my research looking at how decision-making changes when you are sleep deprived and how that can affect lifestyle choices. It's really fascinating.
You know, I don't think we ever actually finished the introduction.
No, we're just halfway there. We're halfway through the introduction.
All right. So we'll get together and do another, the second part of the introduction later. All right. Thanks a lot, Daniel Pardee. Everybody follow him on Twitter, as I should have a long time ago. I just rectified that. What is it? Dan's Plan Health?
Dan's Plan Health, yeah.
All right, Dan's Plan Health. And you have a website as well, right?
Yeah, dansplan.com. We're making really, I'm not sure when this will air, but November 3rd is, we're going to go pushing a bunch of changes that I've been working on. Yeah, it's really, I love it. It's, you know, I wake up, my job affects my sleep because I'm so excited to get started in the day working on it. That, but it's really fun to have that project. So yeah, check it out. It includes a lot of the stuff that we talked about, just how do you, what if, you know, I kind of started with, if you wanted to facilitate health in others, if I was going to create tools, what would you do? And so, you know, you go check it out and you can see some of my work towards that.
Fantastic. What do you call yourself, by the way? What's on your business card?
I'm glad you said, what do you call yourself versus what do other people call me? Well, yeah. So after working in the pharmaceutical industry, I started a PhD. So I'm still working at that slowly, but I'm the CEO of Dan's Plan. Yeah, so those are
just, I mean, generally, do you call yourself a biohacker? Are you a sleep researcher, you know, psychophysiologist? Is there some label that describes the sort of constellation of your interests?
Boy. You know, no, I don't know if I have a specific label, because I kind of dabble in a variety of things. I think I'm probably, you know, most known just for my work in sleep, because, you know, that is what I speak about a lot. There's a lot of interest and need out there for sleep. But I, you know, it's my interest is in wellness, really, and kind of modern wellness. Like, what do we really need to do to counteract these forces that are kind of interfering? But yeah, I'll think about that. Maybe by the next time I'll actually have a title.
All right. Very cool. Hey, thanks, Dan.
Thanks so much. That was great.
He said, baby, what's a big deal? Feel what you want to feel. Say what you want to say. You're going to die one day. For example, I could kiss you. Just because I want to. What's the difference if you turn away? I'm gonna die one day. Why do you waste your time thinking about your reputation? Trying to meet an expectation, wondering what they're gonna say. When everyone you've ever known is headed for a headstone. Your body is an animal, doesn't ask for much. A little music and a soft touch. Why don't you let it out to play? Your heart is in a birdcage, singing in your chest. You wanna shut it up but give it a rest. You're gonna die one day. Why do we waste our time thinking about a reputation? Running from a confrontation, wondering what we ought to say. When everyone we've ever known is headed for a headstone, I don't want to give the end away, but we're gonna die. It's a big deal if you want to be free. Say what you want to feel. Spend the night with me. I'm gonna take you up in my arms. And if we must go down, we'll go singing to the smoke alarms. We'll dance into the ground.